What's up, everybody? This is Healing Intentions, and I'm your host, Dr. Adrian Mimetti. This podcast is about natural health and wellness, mental health, cannabis, psychedelics, philosophy, and spirituality. Today, my guest is Andrew D'Angelo. Andrew is a visionary leader with a proven track record of enacting systemic social change and developing best practices in cannabis. He is the very definition of a trailblazer and someone who has proudly walked the road less traveled. During his almost 13-year tenure at Harborside, where he currently serves as an advisor, Andrew has pioneered legal cannabis business processes and provided groundbreaking political engagement and thought leadership to the cannabis community. Andrew also lends his vast cannabis business and political expertise as a consultant for hire to the global community at large, including several strategic partnerships with the world's leading cannabis-centric service firms. Andrew led the design and development of gold standard cannabis retail by innovating many firsts for the industry. These include introducing CBD medicines to heal severely epileptic children, as documented in Discovery Channel's Weed Wars, implementing the first lab testing program in the history of cannabis dispensing, creating child-resistant packaging for edibles, standardizing inventory tracking, initiating senior outreach, and successfully preventing the federal government from seizing Harborside in forfeiture actions against the company in 2012. Andrew is co-founder and chairperson of the board for the nonprofit Last Prisoner Project, LPP. LPP's mission is to free and reintegrate all cannabis prisoners on Earth into mainstream society. Since its inception in 2019, LPP has successfully reintegrated the formerly incarcerated, and 2020 will be the year LPP frees its first constituent. Andrew is also a founding board of directors member of the California Cannabis Industry Association, the premier cannabis industry trade association in California, where he served from 2013 to 2020, building the organization from zero to 500 member companies. The organization continues to represent the industry in California as it works on reforming Prop 64 to improve the legal and regulatory framework for cannabis trade throughout the state. Graduating with honors from Chapman University with a BFA degree in communications and theater, Andrew began his political career as an activist while studying for his MFA in acting at the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. Over two decades as an activist, Andrew worked on a variety of voter initiatives which legalized medical and adult use cannabis in San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and the state of California. As an actor, Andrew starred in the feature film Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore, which premiered at the Sundance in 1997, and on national television shows like Superior Court, 1987, Homicide, Life on the Street, 1998, as well as dozens of plays across the United States. Andrew also stars in Discovery Channel's reality television series Weed Wars. Between 2002 and 2005, Andrew served as a professor at Chapman University teaching acting. Andrew and his brother Steve recently formed D'Angelo Brothers Productions, DAB, which intends to produce, support, and distribute cannabis content over a variety of mediums and platforms. DAB's mission is to create new mythologies for cannabis in pop culture, smashing the stigma of the lazy stoner and replacing it with fresh and positive representation of cannabis in society. As a speaker, Andrew has appeared at the MJ Business Daily Conference in Las Vegas, ICBC, NCIA conferences in Chicago, Boston, San Jose, Emerald Conference, and the U.S. Cannabis Conference in Miami. Courses on cannabis business training led by Andrew are available online through Greenflower Media. Let's get started. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Healing Intentions. This is your host, Dr. Adrian Mimetti. And today I have a really special guest, Andrew D'Angelo. Welcome, Andrew.
Well, doctor, great to be with you today. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Yeah, of course. I don't believe in any coincidences. You know, I've gone to these cannabis conferences a few times here in Las Vegas and met so many different cool people, but I remember at one of them a few years ago, your brother, Steve D'Angelo, was at one of the after parties, kind of like passing out these solventless dabs and dipping them in the terpenes. And I was just like, wow, this is amazing. I just took a dab from Steve D'Angelo, you know? And then a couple of years later, I'm just strolling around the, you know, the expo floor. And then I run into you. So it's like, you know, pretty cool. So honored to have you.
Yeah. Well, serendipity is part of all of this, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you had that experience with my brother. You don't often catch him late night at parties. So it was good that you got to do that.
Yeah. It was pretty cool. So why don't we just start kind of from the beginning? Tell everybody, you know, your background and how you got, you know, into the cannabis industry, you know, just what got you into that way back in the day and what's kept you, you know, going strong all the way till this point.
Well, sure. As you mentioned, my older brother, Steve D'Angelo, most of your listeners probably are familiar with him. He's almost 10 years older than me. And, so I got introduced to both cannabis as a medicine and a plant through Steve, and also as a cause and as a trade through my older brother. Our family had a lot of tragedy when I was growing up. So by the time, you know, I was 5 or 6 years old, it was just me and my mom, and my brother was helping to support our household when he was 15 or 16, 17 years old. My mom was really good at a lot of things, but making a living wasn't one of them. And so the trade was the way he did that. So I grew up all with that trade sort of around me as I grew up. So it was pretty natural for me to get into this. When I was coming up in the 1980s in high school and college, you know, it was a much different time than it is now. And, it was pretty risky even to just be, a consumer of cannabis,
right?
Let alone someone who traded cannabis. Trading cannabis was a damn dangerous thing to do back then. Mm-hmm. And I was selling weed out of the dorms in my college, in those days. So, mm-hmm. So we were pretty balls to the wall. And I learned a lot of that from my older brother. Of course, I learned a lot of that also just from the cannabis plant itself. Taught me a lot about just being courageous and taking risk and living life to the fullest and trying to serve something larger than yourself. I think those are all things that I learned from cannabis. And so, you know, we were underground for a long time and that didn't feel too good. And especially as we, our business got bigger,
right.
It got a lot more dangerous and stuff. So, we wanted to legalize weed. So we worked on that, you know, and it took a while, but finally in 1996 in California, we were able to do legalized medical. We didn't actively work on that campaign, but we were behind the scenes helping to fund that campaign. And then a couple years later, we did it again in our hometown at that time, which was Washington, D.C. That's where we grew up, was Washington, D.C. That's where my brother lived. I went to college in California. I wanted to run away to California when I was pretty young. Uh-huh. Eventually we were able to legalize weed in enough places and move to California and open Harborside once licensing occurred. And Harborside is a cannabis dispensary we started in 06 in Oakland, California. It's now a publicly traded company, and Steve and I are not part of the operational team anymore. We don't, but we're still shareholders in the company. And we sort of were probably one of the first, if not the first, household name on a level of a cannabis dispensary. So that was sort of our accomplishment. We did that by just serving patients really well and trusting the plant and presenting it as a medicine and, you know, creating a lot of messaging and storytelling around that. And And we created a community center. In those days, you had to be nonprofit in California. And so we were able to invest in a lot of things you can't really invest in now that it's a for-profit market. And so we tried to create community centers, you know, and we did. And so people responded to that really well. And so that's why we got so popular. And then when I left Harborside, I wanted to do something that was, I didn't want to own or operate another cannabis company. So we started a nonprofit organization called Last Prisoner Project. And that organization is dedicated to getting cannabis prisoners out of prison and reentering them into society in a good way. And that's been a great project. The last couple of years, we've really made the organization grown. We've gotten people out of prison. The industry has supported us a lot. And the community has supported us a lot. And you know, we're not the only group doing this work. There's a lot of groups doing the work. They all deserve our support. And now I'm also a consultant. So I help other people build their cannabis companies now. And that's a lot of fun for me because instead of concentrating on one company, like I did with Harborside for 14 years, you know, a long time to be with one project that long. And now I get to build the industry in different states. And I even have a job in Thailand I'm working right now. So other countries, and taking all these years of experience and knowledge that I've just sort of given you the cliff notes on and show people how they can make their goals come true and dreams come true in cannabis. Not everybody wants to build a community center. Some people want to, you know, build something that's more transactional, that makes money. And some people want to, you know, build something that's sort of a hybrid of those two things. And I help people build all three. But I prefer, you know, helping people build community models. And certainly those clients are to the top of my list. So, but that's sort of what we're up to now, what I'm up to now. And what I've done in the past. And I think that, you know, as a movement, as an industry, as a community, the wind's at our backs. And not to say there's challenges, all kinds of challenges that we're dealing with that are horribly difficult and entrenched, but not like it was in the 1980s when, you know, just smoking a joint could get you landed in prison for a long time.
Yeah,
especially if you're a person of color.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, isn't the statistic you're 8 times more likely to be put in prison if you're black or you know, Latino in this country?
Black or brown, yeah, it's really shameful. It's really quite shameful.
Yeah, that's awesome that you have that nonprofit aimed at helping that. Wow, so really nice background there. Thanks for that. Yeah, I've been to Harborside actually up in Oakland, the original store, and really cool experience. And I saw by community center, do you mean kind of like there's acupuncture offered and there's different, you know, other services, mental health and other stuff you could use while you're there?
In those days, yes. You know, when we were a medical dispensary and we were, like I said, in a more of a nonprofit, we had the opportunity and the obligation to invest in those things. So we did. And it wasn't just that. You could write a letter to a prisoner. You could get free medicine if you were, you know, in need. And we had a program for that you could apply for. You know, you come in every Monday and get 1.5 grams of free weed. And, you know, you have to initial and you leave. And, you know, it's a pretty good program for people that, you know, most people that are in need and they get something for free from somebody, the amount of red tape that they have to go through to get that, whatever that thing is enormous. And ours was, you know, just like a postcard you had to basically fill out. And so those were the kind of things we're able to do. Of course, we had a room that allowed us to teach some classes. So we had a bunch of free classes, and then we had the free sort of healthcare, alternative healthcare services, like you mentioned, acupuncture, yoga, Reiki, nutrition, Chinese herbs, things like that. We felt like cannabis was just one of the things we were trying to provide to the community on a health and wellness level, and that cannabis is just really one part of your regimen, as you know, I'm sure, you know, that to be a healthy human being, there's so many things we have to do. And cannabis is just one of those things. So we try to lead by example in those days. You know, it was again a much different time than it is now. And so we wanted to, there weren't a lot of really examples like that in the dispensary sort of ecosystem at that time. And we wanted to sort of raise the bar. And we had a lot of ideas that weren't sort of incorporated yet into the dispensary models in California. So we wanted to incorporate those, like lab testing was something that wasn't done until sort of we came along. There's some blessings and curses in everything you do. So lab testing right now has gotten a little out of control. But in any case, so have taxes, so have regulations, so have a lot of things that we advocated for to normalize cannabis in society. And so now, you know, just like most things in society, the pendulum swings between, you know, competence and incompetence, absurdity and reality, and we'll be no different.
Yeah, I mean, people have to keep in mind that it's a pretty much a new legal industry that's being created as we speak. So, you know, it's never been done before, and so there's going to be bumps along the road. But you know, I kind of understand when I went to one of those cannabis conferences, you know, back in like 2015, that was like the first one I ever went to. And I remember seeing, you know, the guys in the tie dye and the long hair and like the, you know, looking at the guys in the suits, like, I don't know about this. Like, I'm not, doesn't make me feel good, you know? And it's like the kind of the clash of both sides.
Oh yeah. But, like, it's still happening, that clash.
Yep.
Yep.
But both sides are important, you know, to you need both.
Yeah, I've been working hard the last year, and I will be, to build bridges between those communities, since I've always worked hard to build bridges between those communities, because we can't get cannabis into every medicine cabinet on earth as a bunch of cannabis people. We need help doing that.
Right.
You know, the at least not some of the more sophisticated formulations and things like that. Can we get a bag of weed to everybody on earth? Yeah, we did that. The legacy market and the underground market does that very well. There's very few places you can go on earth. I mean, I bet you could probably score a bag of weed in Antarctica from somebody. Yeah. If you know, somebody down there's got to be supplying everybody else. So there's access, but there's in the legal market, some of these formulations you see and some of the potential to unlock in cannabis, it can only be done with sort of building bridges to corporate cannabis. And you know, some of those bridges are going to lead to effed up places. You know, I don't know. That's just global capitalism. It is just, there's some effed up places global capitalism's in right now. And that's going to happen to us. You know, I hope that all of us will get inspiration from the plant and healing from the plant and try to create something different. But there are powerful forces at work, you know, and so we'll win some and lose some, and we'll create an industry, I hope, that's a lot more inclusive than any other industry. We're not anywhere close to doing that yet. In fact, we're actually underperforming mainstream industries on inclusion and diversity and even sustainability. So, you know, we have a very long way to go, but as you said, that the cement is not even drying. It's still being mixed. So it hasn't even been poured yet in terms of what the form of the industry is going to look like, especially when you include industrial hemp and, you know, all these other things that can be done with cannabis, the cannabis plant. So it's just so much potential that we have to unlock right now. And so we're really just an embryo.
It's exciting. It's definitely exciting.
It is. You know,
I thank all of the forefathers like yourself in the industry that have laid the groundwork for the place that we are, excuse me, today, but there's still so much more to go. You know, we're still kind of in the first inning of what's going to be created. And it's really exciting. Like you mentioned, industrial hemp, you know, people say like the cannabis for the people, hemp for the planet. It's really exciting when you talk about hemp and it's all its industrial, you know, applications, mm-hmm. which we've known about for all these years. But, you know, I think now it's kind of really coming to fruition more than ever. So it's exciting. It's exciting to see.
Yeah, I think 2022 industrial hemp will emerge even more. I hope we'll start to see a lot more non-CBD products. I've been seeing a lot more clothing. A lot of this has got hemp in it. Wearing right now. You know, I've been seeing a lot more clothing that I would feel good about wearing and buying. I eat this hemp flour pasta out of Brooklyn that's really good. It's not 100% hemp flour, but it's a blend, but it's great, you know. And so we're starting to see a little bit more food, and they source their hemp from New York, from the United States farmers. Nice. So nice. Most of the hemp food that's on the market right now, when you go to the grocery store and you see hemp oil or something like that, hemp seeds, it's all coming from Canada,
right?
It's all coming from Canada. It's not coming from the United States yet. Most 99.8% of it. But this little company in Brooklyn called Stagnoli, they've cracked the code on it. So it's you know, you're starting to see more of these kind of products coming out of industrial hemp, and I'm really excited about hemp fiber, and I'm really excited about hemp nutrition. I think those are, and I'm excited about hemp building materials, but I think we're still a few years off from sort of the scale and the cultivars and the machines and everything that's needed. It's a shame because all this money that people are spending building cannabis supply chains in all these different states, some of that money could be going into the hemp machinery and the scale that we need for hempcrete and hemp particle board and hemp, you know, building materials that one are a lot more green than concrete, and they're lighter, stronger, and more insulative, and, you know, survive fires and things like that better. So, you know, it's kind of crazy we're not building a lot of things out of hempcrete. Just my house here in California, I got this retaining wall I got to fix, and it's concrete. And it's like, oh man, I wish I had a hempcrete option available to me here. I don't. So I can't like call, hey, use hempcrete, man, I'll pay more. And they're like, can't get it. I would have to import the hemp fiber myself and make my own hempcrete, and I wouldn't be, and the contractors wouldn't use it because they're not insured with it. So, so it's impossible, right? So even somebody like me who's willing to spend a little more to get it done, just so I can say, hey, my retaining wall's made out of hemp, check it out. It's holding up the whole house. So I think that's going to be big frontiers in the next several years. I think we're going to start to see some luxury fiber products at the maybe end of this year. You know, big luxury retailers to getting into hemp. I think we're going to start seeing that. So get ready, Louis Vuitton. We're coming.
I like it. I like it. I actually bought some sneakers that were made out of hemp. It was a GoFundMe campaign or, you know, Kickstarter or something like that. And they were actually really nice. I liked them. I wore them for a while. So,
there's this great company called Fly Soul Shoes. They have more of a dress shoe, and they make them down in Mexico, and they're all handmade and they're beautiful. If you like colorful dress shoes, now they have a more casual kind of slip-ons and stuff too now that they're doing. And so yeah, you're starting to see these things, right? And you're buying them because they're like, whoa, that's something that I'll actually wear. It doesn't look like a hemp burlap sap with a hole cut in it.
Exactly. So Andrew, I wanted to ask you, what's been the most difficult lesson you've learned in the cannabis industry so far?
Well, I think the getting the legalization framework so wrong has been the biggest lesson I've learned, particularly here in California. And, you know, when you legalize something at the state level, it's not like you get to write your own law. You have to make all these compromises. And in a state the size of California, at the time that we were doing that, we had some pretty entrenched in forces like law enforcement, the League of Cities, the League of Counties, local people, very powerful forces here in California. And they successfully lobbied the funders of the initiative to put certain provisions in that were a disaster. A lot of those provisions have been duplicated all over the country, like local control, right? So locals can ban dispensaries. Well, that doesn't work because the people already voted to legalize them. And now you're going to ban them at the local level. And that's just crazy. That's prohibition by minority rule. And that's not how it's supposed to work around here. So it's a big problem. And taxes, you know, we were the first. Harborside went to the city of Oakland, said, you need to raise our taxes. Many, many years ago, this is 07, 08, because we were paying the same business taxes as everyone else. And we wanted, again, more legitimacy. We wanted, because we were running into problems with the federal government. We were running into problems with people getting raided and busted. And we needed protection from the local people. And we thought, well, we pay a little more tax, we'll get this protection in return. And, you know, it's just gotten out of control with the taxes. Now the city of Oakland charges you 10% or 9.5% just for every, you know, dollar you take in. You got to give almost 10 cents to the city of Oakland. So, and then you got to give another 15 cents to the state, and then another, you know, so many cents to the another tax. There's two taxes at the state level. Mm-hmm. So, it's crazy. And the price of weed is just so expensive that no one can afford to buy it in the legal market in California, particularly if you're a heavy consumer or you're a patient that needs a lot of medicine or you just love cannabis, right? And and it's a big part of your life. You can't afford it. And that's true in Illinois, and it's true in Massachusetts, and it's true in, you know, many places that have legalized. So getting the public policy right is, you know, we didn't have a lot of choice. We had to legalize first, unfortunately, but I learned so much about public policy and getting that right. And so, and it was a bitterly hard lesson, not just for the whole community, but for me and my brother personally. So, you know, we had to hand over control of our company that we had for 14, 15 years to our investors. So that's just what had to happen. That's not the outcome I wanted. I wanted to be running Harborside till I was, you know, ready to retire or drop dead or both. And so, you know, it's been a really bitterly hard thing to learn. And the good news is, I think places like New York are starting to learn from these bad frameworks. Their frameworks are a lot better. New Mexico also did a much better job on their framework. So I'm seeing improvement. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's going to be probably the rest of my lifetime, certainly. And I still got a good 20, 30 years to go until all these things are worked out, you know, even if the Fed's legalized, and which I don't quite think they're ready to, but there's just so much, like you said, that we have to learn and figure out, especially when you look at advanced cannabinoid medicines, and when you start looking at industrial hemp, and when you start, you know, you can literally make components of the phone, the internal components of the phone, out of hemp.
Right.
So it's just amazing what you can do with the plant, and how helpful it can be when we're talking about the climate crisis. So I expect that, you know, 30 years from now, instead of, oh God, I forget how much it is of corn that's planted, something like 5 million acres of corn, or I don't know, it might be more than that, might be 50 million, but just a huge amount of acreage to corn.
Yeah.
I think industrial hemp had 500,000, you know, acres, you know, 500,000 acres at the most, you know. So we have such a long way to go, you know, to displace crops like corn, and you know, start, because hemp nutrition is a lot more efficient than corn nutrition. So I expect that when I'm, you know, ready to be an old man and sort of retire, that, you know, I'll be able to build my whole house out of hempcrete and particle board and everything I wear and eat and, you know, the medicines, and, you know, I'll be taking, you know, if I God forbid, happen to get something serious, there'll be like all these great cannabis medicines 25, 30 years from now. And, you know, there'll be sort of a golden age, I think, going on, because it's just, we're going to learn so much more about the plant. If we could just keep the operating system open source, you know, and a level playing field, or as level as you can make a playing field in the world, then, you know, I think we can have a golden age. If it's some oligarchy, you know, we won't have a golden age because they won't care about innovating. There's so, even those folks would care about innovating for a while because there's so much money to be made. I mean, if you just look at how much, I don't know how much concrete, the global concrete market must be trillions. I mean, it must be trillions. And so, okay, go get it.
Yep.
Go get it, man. And so, you know, and all you need to make hempcrete is the actual hemp stock to be dried and cured a certain way. And limestone and water. That's it. That's all there is to it.
Okay. And, yeah. I'm with you.
I mean, it's all there is to it. And these are plentiful ingredients. Limestone and water aren't as plentiful as they were when I was a little boy, but they're still pretty plentiful in the global scheme of things.
Right.
And so, you know, if we just plant more hemp and make hempcrete, and the great thing about it is it's local, right? Most concrete that we consume, we don't bring in. I mean, it's pretty local. I think, I mean, you see these concrete places all over, right? Because it has to, there's only so far you can transport this stuff.
It's exciting. It's really exciting what's going to happen. And, you know, that brings, I think they're kind of hand in hand, but, you know, not so much in some people's eyes, but Cali sober, cannabis, psychedelics, realm of things, you know, talk about that a little bit. You wrote some articles about Cali sober. It's something that's new to me, but tell everybody what the Cali sober lifestyle is about.
Sure. Love to. I just learned about it myself a couple of years ago. And a lot of us, when we learn about Cali sober, we go, oh, hold on, I've been doing that for decades.
Right.
So it's one of those aha things, and it's a new term for an old practice, right? And it's basically, look, there's terrible problems with dependency and addiction in our society. The drug war makes it worse. What happens with prohibition, doesn't matter what the product is, generally speaking, is it makes the product smaller and it makes the product more potent. That's what pro. So now at the, and to the extreme, you get fentanyl.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very small, very, very potent, easy to smuggle, easy to transport, hard to get caught with, you know, perfect underground drug. But not so much for the end user. Not so much for the toxicity, not so much for the human body,
right?
Let alone the human mind. So there's a real crisis. Not everybody can be 12 steps sober, AA sober. Not everybody, that operating system of sobriety doesn't work for everybody. And not everybody feels comfortable in those circles, in those types of recovery circles. But there are people that need to be in a traditional 12-step sober recovery circle. And anyone listening that needs to be in that should be in that. And right. not be tempted to get off of your path because I'm advocating something that includes intoxicants. Mm-hmm. So the Cali Sober operating system for sobriety includes cannabis and psychedelic use. Mm-hmm. It might also include moderate alcohol use. The bottom line is you're in control of the substance. The substance is not in control of you. And many of us find that I'm daily cannabis. I take cannabis every single day. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to 12-step folks, a lot of them or some of them might say, well, you're addicted to cannabis. And so your doctor, you know, and addiction is this very tricky thing. And it's a right. hard thing to measure, and it's a hard thing to, but it's also, you know it when you're experiencing it. Right. I think most people know it when they're experiencing it.
Definitely.
And they know when they're having an issue. And, it sometimes take, you know, like, you have to hit bottom and then you get help and so forth and so on is a typical pattern. But not everybody hits bottom. Some people realize, hey, I need to get help before I hit bottom. Mm-hmm. and people should get that help. But Cali Sober is just, you know, that daily cannabis use. I don't drink alcohol. Don't take any hard drugs. I do take psychedelics occasionally, not, you know, a few trips a year. And I take my cannabis every day, and I'm a very high functioning person. Mm-hmm. And have a great life I've created for myself. So I'm on a good path. I'm not, you know, I'm not thinking about getting stoned all day long. I take breaks when, you know, after this conversation, I'll probably take a little break, 5 minute, 10 minute break, take a little cannabis, come back, get into my next, you know, task or workflow that I'm doing for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it goes. You know, that's how the day goes every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I find that allows me to do highly stressful things in a place where I'm not constantly being triggered by the stress. And but I also, you know, I make sure I'm not too stoned when I'm doing something like an interview or a podcast. Mm-hmm. I titrate my dosages. I'll take a 1-to-1. I love doing 1-to-1 ratio CBD to THC when I appear, when I speak or when I appear. It just works. So gets me in a creative flow, but I don't lose my train of thought.
Right.
And that's, I think, you know, the balance that I'm trying to strike. A lot of people are trying to strike. So it's dry January. A lot of people are trying to not drink this month because we come out of the holidays and people sometimes over imbibe. And so taking a little cannabis, maybe having a psychedelic experience. A lot of people find microdosing with psychedelics is helpful for them. Mm-hmm. Keeping on sort of a sober path or a path of being in control, mm-hmm. if you will, mm-hmm. and see how it works. You know, when it's January 18th and you haven't had a drink in 17 days and you're feeling that feeling, get yourself some weed, you know,
I agree.
and see if that does something for you. And if you're new, just take a couple puffs, one or two mm-hmm. puffs, or, you know, don't take too much, right. And just, you know, and just see. And a lot of people find, okay, once the onset of that cannabis comes into the body, that craving for that alcohol either subsides greatly to the point where your own discipline and self-control can step in and say, all right, we're going to say no to that. Or you just don't want to, you know, you're stoned and you're fine and you're great. And, you know, you just don't need the drink. And so that's Cali Soap. And you know, cannabis is not a toxic compound the way alcohol is. Yep. Do people misuse cannabis? Of course, some people do. But if you misuse cannabis, what's going to happen to you is a lot less harmful than if you misuse alcohol, and probably a lot less harmful to the people around you, and other things around you, like other motorists perhaps.
Yeah.
So you know, that's Cali Sober in a nutshell. And you, as I mentioned, a lot of people I talk to about this, perhaps you're the same way, were like, I didn't know the name, but I've been doing this for, you know, this is my regimen, this is how I go about it too. I'm a cannabis, you know, this is. And sometimes, you know, they'll whisper, yeah, I'm Cali Sober too. And exactly. You know, like, I'm like, don't be ashamed of it.
Right.
But
right.
Like, alcohol is so prevalent in our society. Like, a lot of people have a hard time staying on the path of sobriety. Like, I was talking to someone who's a performer from our community, mm-hmm. and she's a pretty big name, and she sometimes struggles, you know, with drinking, mm-hmm. and she's famous. So, mm-hmm. you know, she performs, she has events, people buy her drinks, people send her bottles of champagne, and, you know, she's a celebrity. So it's like really hard, to not say yes. You don't want to be a wet blanket. You don't want to let down your fans. You want to stay connected to everybody. And especially if you're kind of new to being a celebrity as she is. Mm-hmm. And so Cali Sober really helps her, you know, stay on a healthier path, and as someone who's just got alcohol around her all the time, you know, and we all do, you know, you get on the airplane, alcohol, you go everywhere you go. When you really start to observe it, you'll see it everywhere. It's just complete. And it's great that, you know, there's access to that, I guess, everywhere. But it certainly isn't fair that there's not access to, for us cannabis folks to also be able to do that and have that integration in society. So mm-hmm. I think that this operating system for sobriety, one, and two, Cali Sober is just a lifestyle. You know, there's lots of people who are Cali Sober who never were addicts. Right. Or never had problems with addiction, I should say. Mm-hmm. The word addict is not right, but yeah. it's more proper to say people who struggle with addiction. But you know, but not everyone has struggled with addiction who practices Cali Sober, and they still find it helps them live a more creative, productive, calm, connected social life that's less isolated and a lot of and then there's a lot of folks that take alcohol because it's social. And, you know, once we have consumption lounges, which I know I think you want to talk about too today, but once we have more access to those kind of experiences in every town in the country,
right?
You know, I think we'll start to see people take a lot less alcohol and people will start to take more cannabis and people will start getting Cali sober tattoos.
That's for sure going to happen. Well, it's no wonder that in all the states that cannabis is legalized, alcohol sales are down like 15 or 20%, right? Same with opioid prescription rates. So it's like, well, that is for sure the trend. So it's exciting.
That's right. The early returns seem to indicate that that's the trend. So, you know, but the returns are still pretty early. So we have a ways to go. The pandemic kind of probably threw a data curve in there because I think people just drank and smoked and did everything more, consumed everything more, food, meat, comfort foods, everything, bacon. So, you know,
that's for sure.
By the grace of the universe, we're coming out of that now. Although we have Omicron, we're not coming out of it now, but gosh, I hope we do soon.
I hope so too. I think it's right around the corner here. So speaking of the future here, you mentioned on-site consumption lounges. Where do you see those coming into play? I know there's a couple out I've read about, I've never been to one, but what's going on with those? I'm really excited about those. A lot of other cannabis consumers are. How long are those going to take and what's your outlook on all that?
Well, the first ones to open were in California, actually. A couple of years ago, San Francisco had some and Coachella Valley, Palm Springs and places like that. You can walk in to consumption lounges now. And Vegas is going to open a couple, I think. You know, Planet 13 is going to have a big giant one. And it's going to be really interesting because, again, no one's done it before. So is everyone going to imitate alcohol? What kind of devices? Are you going to be able to combust or is it only going to be drinks or edibles? Is it going to be, okay, you're allowed to have a vape pen, but you're not allowed to take a dab, or you're allowed to have a dab and a vape pen, but you're not allowed to smoke a joint, or you can smoke a joint outside and take a dab outside, but you can only have a vape pen inside. Or who knows? Right. And that outside has to be so many feet from anybody else's inside. And, and we can go on and on and make fun of the absurd rules that will be rolled out at first, you know, and like the models in California, basically they're all attached to a dispensary. You buy whatever you want to consume in the dispensary. Then you go into the lounge and you consume it. There are some lounges like the ones in Palm Springs I mentioned that will let you bring your own in, but most of them don't because they don't make money that way. Right. So most of them have spent quite a bit of money to get open just to get the license. And, you know, a lot of them have to put air filtration in and,
right,
smell mitigation, all one thing after another. So it's expensive. And so they can't just let people come in and hang out all day and bring their own weed and bring their own water and just sit there. So there's going to be different models, you know. I'm actually consulting with a couple groups with this right now, and there's going to be a whole bunch of different models, but, you know, I can see, but it is exciting. And, I think there's going to be people that figure it out, just like we kind of did with Harborside and retail. There's going to be someone's going to figure it out. And then that model is going to sort of get duplicated and then it'll get disrupted by something else and sort of the creative destructive process of, Free markets will sort of do its thing, but it is the next step in the integration of cannabis into society. So and every step has this like headwind, right? So DUI is the headwind to consumption lounges. So all the enemies of cannabis are going to say, oh, you're going to get in all these car wrecks and you're going to have all the DUI and we're going to, we're going to have like DUI traps right down the street from the consumption lounge. And, you know, there's going to be this whole thing with DUI is going to be sort of the headwind to the consumption models, I think. So, yeah. So everything has a headwind, right? We mentioned regulation and taxes. That's a headwind. But entrepreneurs are generally stubborn. Greed is generally a hell of a motivator, and people figure it out despite the constraints and the crappy public policy and everybody getting it wrong at first. But I look forward to it. The coffee shop model in Amsterdam is a model that they figured out. Will we have the regs right to do that model here? I don't know, but that's a model. Some places are going to let you, probably Vegas first, bring alcohol into these places and drink it if you want. There's going to be most places I think are not going to allow alcohol and cannabis to be mixed. I certainly hope not. I hope not. Yeah. I don't want to see them mixed. Maybe like in that 30-year span we were talking about a second ago, maybe by then there's some mixture going on. But right now I think, never the twain should meet. And it'll be fun. It'll just be really fun to experience these models and check them out and see what people are up to and see what they're doing, see what they create and see how it speaks to you. And you might get inspired to create a better one.
Yeah, no, that's exciting. It's interesting you mentioned the headwinds and DUI being for consumption lounges. I really am not hearing much about like this increase in DUIs. Is that a thing? Like, is that something that's really like,
or
is
no, that it's not
the opposition says?
No, it's just what the opposition says. It's just what law enforcement says. It's just what our adversaries say. Just like when we tried to open dispensaries, it was crime's going to go up. There's going to be a bunch of drug addicts in the neighborhood. Everybody's going to be smoking joints in their car, driving out of the dispensary. They're going to get wrecks. The sky is going to fall upon the community. And none of that happened at all.
Right.
At all. Quite the opposite happened. Crime is lower around the dispensaries, generally speaking, than it is otherwise around the liquor store, say, since we're talking a lot about alcohol. It's just unfounded, and I know, and perhaps, that people who take cannabis and get behind a wheel have a different safety profile than people that drink alcohol and get behind the wheel. You simply cannot compare the two. It's like comparing firing a gun to making love to somebody. They're just totally different things. You just can't compare them. One's going to kill you and the other one's going to reproduce you, maybe. They're completely opposite things. And so I think that the important thing when we're talking about driving a vehicle or showing up to your job, okay, because we have this issue in cannabis businesses.
Right. Is not
are you too stoned or not, are you too drunk or not? The question is, are you too impaired to do your job or drive this car? Right. If you are, you need to go home.
Right.
Or you need to stop driving the car, and we might have to put you in this little cage overnight. you're driving. And you fail a field impairment test. The same thing's going to happen to you if you fail that test. Doesn't matter what compound you're on. Mm-hmm. So that's how I think we should treat it. And then it really doesn't matter where you set up the checkpoint. You don't have to set it up right down the street from the consumption lounge or right down the street from the bar even. You can set it up anywhere because it's all about impairment. And
right.
And it's and it makes sure that law enforcement doesn't target underserved communities with this, I don't know, this supposed cannabis DUI thing. It's coming. All right. Yep. This cannabis is a DUI threat. It came and went in California somewhat, but it's still out there, and it's going to come more and more. And when we've got tens of millions of more people consuming the plant than we do now, you know, I think the bigger danger is you're driving your car while you're distracted on your cell phone is the biggest danger. It's bigger than drunk driving. It's bigger than stone driving. It's bigger than,
yep.
I don't even think stone driving is that big a threat. I think people generally drive more carefully when they're stoned. But yeah. I know I do. I drive slower. I drive like a little old lady. You know, people make fun of me because I'm like driving around like 55 down. I love driving 55 when I'm stoned. you drive like a little old lady and it's pretty safe. I mean,
literally, yeah.
You know, you're kind of grooving along and pretty hyper aware of what's around you, you know? And so that's been my experience, but mm-hmm. all the people I know, all the stoners I know, they're not going around wrecking people and hurting people in cars. But I can't name one that's happened to.
Yeah.
So, and I can name plenty of drunks that's happened to in my life, including people in my own family, you know, yeah. that you DUI, you know, over and over again, got DUIs, you know,
yep.
terrible.
Yep. No, I agree. I know people and families and friends that have been personally affected by drunk drivers have lost, you know, family members and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's a serious thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't want to make light of any of it,
right.
but of course. It is, we're talking about a totally different compound here. And so,
yep.
so that's sort of the headwind on consumption lounges. But I think that, again, it's kind of like with dispensaries. Yeah. There's always headwinds, but the benefits outweigh the headwinds.
Yeah,
and I think that's definitely the case with consumption lounges. Look, if you live in public housing, you might not be able to smoke weed in your apartment,
right?
Without risking eviction,
right?
So you need a consumption lounge in that neighborhood, or more than one of them, maybe. You just have to have it. That's why New York legalized consumption lounges out of the gate. The first state, I think New Mexico did that too. The first two states to legalize consumption out of the gate. Imagine the five boroughs. If you don't have that, people will be complaining about weed smoke and smell all over the place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the consumption lounge just takes a lot of pressure off of that. And it helps integrate into society. The other thing that's about to happen is, and you've seen this in Massachusetts and other really uptight places, is the smell of cannabis. Now it becomes this thing that becomes a headwind. I know cannabis companies who have had to pay off people in Massachusetts to the tune of 50 grand a house for a house that was a mile away from the grow.
Whoa.
A mile away.
Wow.
Because they're complaining that they smell weed down there. So, and they do not smell weed down there. They smell an opportunity to get 50 grand out of a weed company. So wow. they take it. And the politicians back them up and the local people back them up. And, you know, if you want to keep your license, you better give these people $50,000.
That's amazing. Wow.
And there's 10 of them. So that's $500,000. There's 10 houses in the subdivision. and they all got together. And they'll crush you, right? They're your neighbor, technically your neighbor. And so this kind of thing you see in terms of headwinds and those are two pretty unknown subtle ones. We haven't even talked about local bans and things like that. So
Right. No, that's just a add to the list of all the things that we'll look back at and just, you know, laugh at and find so silly, but that are just something we have to deal with right now. It's, you know, and that kind of brings me to my other question. How will the legalization and this whole renaissance with psychedelics that's happening now, how will this be different, in your opinion, than the way cannabis happened? And what lessons can us, I put myself in there, the psychedelic activists, entrepreneurs, learn from you cannabis pioneers and not kind of repeat the same mistakes? How do you compare and contrast those two? I know a lot of people lump them together. There's a lot of similarities, but there's a lot of differences too. What would you say to that?
Well, it's a great question. It's a question we all have to ask and answer over and over again. None of us have a complete understanding of it. But if we want to avoid the mistakes of the cannabis industry and psychedelic, it's really important. You know, I can tell the story of California best because that's where I lived and owned and operated companies and still live and consult with a lot of companies. And so we had a nonprofit model that was a medical model, and we could do things like build community centers, or if you will, a community trip center. Let's just say, and it was nonprofit, so there wasn't this motivation. There was no motivation. There was no exuberance in the ecosystem. There was no irrational exuberance in the ecosystem. There was only people who wanted to heal and do health and wellness and therapeutics, cannabis therapeutics. That's all there was.
Yep.
So, and then we had adult use, we went for profit, and all of a sudden we became something much, much different out here. And now all it is, the therapeutic models are all gone. And they've been they're being operated out of caregivers' homes and little collectives people have under the old law, but they're pretty much gone, therapeutic models, in terms of a community model. And it's all decentralized now. And it's a shame. It's almost like it's gone back underground to a certain degree. And then you have all this irrational exuberance and all these companies building moats and lobbying lawmakers to keep legacy people out. And, you know, just the crap show that is what it is in California right now. And that's the path the psychedelic community has to avoid. And it's not avoiding it right now because there's already publicly traded psychedelic companies. Because I guess the listeners, you may have already talked about this on the podcast, but the way it works is you got a group like MAPS, the multi-association and multidisciplinary association of psychedelic studies. MAPS, they're a nonprofit organization. They've been working on getting psychedelics through these government studies, FDA studies, so they can get approved for a trip that you take at a trip center with blindfold on in a room, and you have a guide, and you've done all this psychotherapy beforehand. You've set all these intentions, and you've done a couple weeks worth of work before you take the trip, and then you do about a week or two of work after you take the trip. And it's a whole regimen that MAPS has developed. And they're the best. And I think the whole world should do whatever Rick Doblin says when it comes to psychedelics, because I think he's very smart, and he's given this the most thought and study of anyone on the planet. But then MAPS has another organization that's going to actually make the MDMA and sell it to the trip centers. And that's going to be a for-profit entity that's going to then give all the profits back to MAPS so that they can open more nonprofit trip centers. Okay. And so you're going to have these nonprofit trip centers that are giving people drugs that are being made for profit. So all these publicly traded companies right now are trying to be the supplier of the drugs to the trip centers. Some of them are vertically integrated, and they're going to have both drugs and trip centers. And that's what I'm seeing on the landscape right now. And that's kind of how it works. So the money is not so much at the Trip Center, because it's hard to make money at the Trip Center, because you're just giving people an awful lot of labor hours to make that profitable. What you make money on is the actual drug. So, you know, and an insurance company pays for that. And so if it's $500 to take a hit of ecstasy at a Trip Center, your insurance company pays it. You have a copay of $10 today. Wouldn't that be great? And so that's how everyone's getting really excited, because they're like, well, there's, I don't know, 1 billion or 2 billion people on Earth with depression and this and that, and things that trauma and PTSD and things that these trials for psychedelics are addressing, these specific things, PTSD, right, addiction, trauma from, because you got a diagnosis that you're going to die right, soon. These are the areas of therapeutics that are being studied first and put through the trials first. So they're going to be the first ones out in the market. And my hope is that, you know, when I talked to Rick Doblin, I said, how do we avoid the mistakes? He's like, well, we probably can't avoid all of them, because the need to get the medicine into as many bodies as possible is greater than the need for us to keep everything nonprofit. So I was like, Rick, why don't we just keep the whole thing nonprofit, make that an international law, and we're done. We don't have to worry about all these problems anymore. He's like, nah, we won't be able to get enough people tripping fast enough to do the therapeutics at the global scale that we need to get to heal the planet. So the for-profit, he suggested that the nonprofit models and the for-profit models compete with each other, and may the best model win. And you know, I trust his judgment. And the lessons I learned in cannabis are different than that. And maybe Rick should trust my judgment a little bit too, because I think there's a middle ground there. I don't think it would do any harm for us to say, okay, the first few years is nonprofit. It gets all this exuberance out of the marketplace. It gets all this, and the exuberance is what brings in a lot of money. Okay. It makes the thing scale. And that's what Rick is saying. He's like, I can't scale it fast enough with maps alone. I need a lot of help. So I think that's where he's coming from. I think there's a balance to be struck. So for me, decrim is step number one. Okay, so let's stop locking people up. Let's stop getting the police after people. Let's get people. Most people trip in the safety of their own home. You don't have too many stories right now of bad trips leading to really bad public health outcomes. Whether you just don't have that many emergency room visits, you just don't have that much of it. Right. As these compounds, again, as tens of millions of more people do this, you have to be mindful of that. But I mean, even if you look at MDMA hit the scene when I was in college in the 80s, and between the 80s and now, I don't know, billions of doses of MDMA have probably been consumed by people. And not to say there hasn't been some harm in some of those doses and experiences and even fatalities, but generally speaking, the amount of harm that's been done when you compare that to what the harm alcohol's done since the 80s. You get two drastically different profiles when you study the data on that. Yep. So you know, I again, it's kind of like, so I think decrim is step one. I think step two, I think you have to have a nonprofit model step in there. I think I would like to see like we had in California there, and it really was helpful. And then perhaps we can ease into something that has more exuberance in it, and more scale. But if it ends up going the way Rick says, I won't be disappointed as long as the people that have been carrying this medicine for decades are allowed to keep carrying it. And they have a place in the legal, they have an important place, not just a like off to the corner place, but they have a central place and role that has existed for a long time that should remain. Mm-hmm. It's going to look and smell and taste different than it does now, being completely underground. And we're going to have to accept that. And it will be hard to accept, but we have to accept that. But what's not acceptable is for us to get pushed out and for these moats to be built around these companies that nobody can penetrate. And then all of a sudden we have this ogliarchy again. And that's not how this medicine is supposed to be handled and carried and shared. So certain, and even cannabis, which is a tryptophan, by the way, cannabis is a mild psychedelic in itself. We're already tripping, you know, with cannabis. So, So, you know, it's those are some of the things that I worry about, right? I also worry about people not being educated, mm-hmm. About these compounds and not taking them in the correct set and setting. And there doesn't need to be too many bad set and settings for something terrible to go wrong with these compounds. Okay. If you've never tripped on 100 micro mics of LSD and you do, and you happen to be in an automobile, even if you're not driving,
right?
Not a good set and setting.
Yeah.
You know, and you might not even know that because someone just handed you this acid and, you know, you've read about acid being this, you know, thing. And I don't know, somebody you trust or whatever. And then all of a sudden you're tripping balls and, you know, you might be driving a car. You might be a passenger. You might be on a bus or you might be on a subway or you are on an airplane and you could have a freak out, you know, and it could just be, you know, you might find yourself, you know, taped down to an airplane chair and arrested upon arrival, you know, because you had a freak out and you were in the wrong set and setting.
Yeah.
So, and I worry about that too. I think that's the other thing that will, as more millions of people get, because decrim increases access. See, that's the idea. And then you have more access, but you don't have perhaps all of the things that legalization might provide on the educational front, or at least starts to try to provide on the educational front. And then you've got people who are just trying to make money slinging whatever they can sling underground. And all of a sudden you start getting these set and setting problems. So that's another thing I worry about with the integration of psychedelics.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a big fan of harm reduction over prohibition. I think that's part of the whole Cali sober lifestyle, you know?
Yeah. Harm reduction is just a previous terminology for Cali sober. That's right. All it is. That's basically the same operating system. We called it harm reduction. I think Cali sober is more fun.
Yeah.
Than harm reduction. And a lot of people object to the word sober in there. So that's kind of a interesting argument that's happening in the community right now. But I don't know how to change it. It's already in pop culture pretty intensely. And, you know, we could call it stoner sober or something like that. But But Cali sober is sort of out there. So mm-hmm. I think we're good, or I guess, and I should say Cali stoner, not Cali sober. But that's the word Cali sort of covers stoner.
Right.
So I think that you have to look at both of the words together. You can't just say, oh, you're not sober, and how dare you use that word, and it's very offensive to me. I think you have to look at both of the words together and mm-hmm. and you know, be nuanced about it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I wanted to mention, when you're talking about MAPS and MDMA, I agree. I love what they're doing, and everything Rick Doblin says is awesome. He's a genius for sure. And it's just really interesting how most likely MDMA will be legalized federally as a prescription drug, yet cannabis is still federally illegal. It's just so interesting and crazy how that has come about, you know, but federally, hopefully it changes soon too. I know there's a bunch of bills.
Rick's just done a very good job. Frankly, Rick did a better job than we did. He's been able to work the FDA system in ways that, you know, people like me and my brother would not even try to do, because we get busted by the DEA. Rick's not out there selling MDMA and at the same time trying to legalize MDMA. He had to go through decades and decades of just rejection and red tape and just the feds and the DEA just punching him in the face over and 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 over. Yep. And then he learned how to write all the applications and write all the, you know, and do it all in a way that, you know, follow the FDA would have to violate their own rules, basically. Mm-hmm. And it helped that not all of these were Schedule One. Rick did a really good job. They just, that community's done a really good job, being stewards of this process. And I think the feds also really hate cannabis and the cannabis community with a passion. Certain aspects of the feds do.
Yeah.
Maybe some of that's changing right now, but it's really, really vitriolic the way that energy comes from the DEA and the feds with respect to cannabis. It's been like that since the old Harry S. Anslinger got it all started for us back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, up to Nixon doing the Controlled Substances Act. Before that, it was Anslinger was our Nixon. Then it was Nixon, then it was Reagan. I guess Reagan was sort of the last of the big prohibitionist boogeymen that we had were the Reagans, but you know, they all of them after that, George H. Bush was terrible. He launched a huge war against us, so he was bad too. He was terrible. Clinton wasn't very, the crime bill happened under Clinton and Biden for that matter, and that was terrible for our community. So both parties really piled on with this. And that's why, you know, social justice is a big part of what we're doing here, because of that history. I welcome the MDMA getting legal if faster, whatever, man. It's not a race. It's about all of us hugging at the end of the finish line.
Exactly.
More than it's about who's going to get over the finish line first. And I don't know, it's just enormously hard to get people to change their position on cannabis at the highest levels of the federal government. It's just enormously difficult.
Yeah, sure. I mean, how do you get the government to admit they've been lying to us for all these years? It's kind of hard, you know. That's ultimately what it is. So
it's not that hard. Sanjay Gupta did it,
right?
And
admit it.
He did it. He did it, and he did it with grace and honor and respect. And
you're right.
And and didn't kill his career. It mm-hmm. made him bigger. And so it's not that hard to do. They don't want to do it because of pride and appearing weak or whatever mm-hmm. governments fear. I don't know. I'm not a government. I don't know what they fear. I've never worked for them, but for some reason, you know, they're just absolutely terrified of cannabis and not too happy with us. and don't really view us as true equals at all. So, and that's the real tragedy. Because we are, and everybody should be, and that level playing field again is something that's eluding the cannabis industry. It's probably eluding every industry, honestly, with what's happened in the last several decades with all that. But, you know, I remember when I was a kid and you wanted to get a prescription filled, you went to the local drugstore owned by somebody, you wanted to get an ice cream, you went to the ice cream store, you wanted to get, and now, you know, you go to CVS or Walgreens or, you know, you don't, you know, you get, you might have an ice cream shop in a college, I don't know, some towns might have them, most don't. And you know, you just buy your ice cream at the store and it's, you know, a 7-Eleven or whatever. And so that's what it's become. And it's hopefully we'll get back to a more level playing field in all these industries. And maybe by building a new one from scratch, we can get that right from Jump Street. In mm-hmm. both cannabis and psychedelics, even though it's not trending that way in cannabis now, we're still just embryos, and you know, there's still a lot of things that need to be decided, and there's going to be a lot of battles fought and won, and some lost, and you know, nobody can see into the future. You know, with respect to cannabis and psychedelics, what I've learned in all my years trading cannabis, I was not a much of a psychedelic trader, just enough to have access, you know, but all my years trading cannabis, what I learned is that the plant does all the work for us. My job is to just get it in the hands of as many people as I can. And that's kind of the idea, I think, behind psychedelics too. And we have to be mindful in different ways of psychedelics with set and setting. And, you know, they're powerful compounds, more powerful than cannabis. And so in many respects, you know, but it, the plants themselves is where the magic is, and not us. We just present it. We just carry it around. We just move it around. We just present it. That's what I've truly believed since I was a teenager and I started doing this. I believed that intuitively. Or I was just like, wow, this thing makes people happy. This thing makes people relaxed. This thing makes people connected to me. That feels good for me too. So I'm going to keep doing this. So, you know, the medium is the message to a certain degree.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. And cheers to continued getting it into as many people's hands as possible and getting the education out there and the information and the truth out there. And that's what I'm doing with this podcast and, you know, every conversation I have every day with people. So I really enjoyed having you on the podcast, Andrew. It's been great. I know there's lots more we could talk about, but we've both got time commitments. So I really appreciate you and definitely see you around soon, I'm sure, at another conference.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, doctor. See you next time.
All right. Thank you. We'll be right back.